On ABC Radio National, this is Artworks. I'm Amanda Smith, and 1,000 years ago, I worked as a waitress at the Last Laugh Theatre Restaurant. This was a comedy and cabaret venue in Collingwood in Melbourne. It was run by John Pinder and Roger Evans, and it's where many a career in showbiz was launched. It was also here that the Melbourne International Comedy Festival had its genesis. This year, the Comedy Festival is celebrating its Silver Jubilee. 25 years, thousands of comedians, millions of jokes, and squillions of laughs. These days, the festival is huge and wildly popular. It's a place to see overseas and local comedians, big names and complete unknowns. Ever since it began, the Comedy Festival has produced and curated some of its shows, like any mainstream arts festival does, as well as having an open door policy. Anyone who wants to get into the program and put on a show can. So the way a fringe festival works. Now, operating across both of these structures, a festival that's part curated, part open slather, some see this as a great strength and the dynamic tension that holds the festival together. Others see it as intrinsically unfair. Later in this feature, Suzanne Donisthorpe will tease out some of these points of contention with the director of the festival, Susan Proven, and the writer and director, Lauren Clark. But first, Suzanne has inadvertently hit on another point of contention, going back to the start of it all with one of the founders of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, John Pinder.
You realise that this 25th anniversary of the Melbourne Comedy Festival is a complete mistake. They've got it wrong. It actually started a year before, in, I think, 1986, when we ran, at The Last Laugh, a package of short two-week seasons, and we titled the package The First Melbourne International Comedy Festival. So, in fact, it's the 26th anniversary of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. The Last Laugh was a very big room with a very high ceiling, which allowed us to do, and a decent stage, unlike most of the other venues, which allowed us to do production shows. And this we did in spades over a period from the mid-70s with the longest season we ever had was the first season of Circus Oz, and it ran for about 8 months.
And that meant that you could have trapeze acts coming from the roof and the waiters were involved and nobody in the place wasn't a performer. There wasn't a single soul there.
Pretty much. Our entire staff, apart from the kitchen, were pretty much young drama students and the like, learning their chops and, I hope, influenced by what we were doing rather than Shakespeare and Brecht.
Now, let's go back to 1986. Now, you had a show on at The Last Laugh with a lineup that would cost millions to stage today, and it's not because of the set, but because it boasted a rather stellar lineup. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I was in London in 1985 with Circus Oz, and a young percussionist invited us to go to a strip club in the Raymond Review Bar in the West End, where one of the rooms had been converted to the comic strip. And there were a bunch of unknown acts on, including French and Saunders, Alexei Sale, most of the cast of The Young Ones, and a whole variety of other people, including the percussionist who sang a punk version of the Teddy Bear's Picnic and then collapsed on stage. This inspired me because it was not unlike what we were up to in Melbourne. And I invited a group of these people to come to The Last Laugh.
I said, hands up, who likes...
Rick, we heard what you said.
Why don't you like me?
Because you're a complete bastard.
Vivian, I'm being serious.
So am I. You're a complete bastard and we all hate you.
I find that rather difficult to believe.
Do you want a bet on it? I'll put down a fiver.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, count me in as well.
I don't bet.
Coward!
Yeah, yellow cheeky.
All right, I'm not scared.
Quiet, everybody. The bet's on.
Right. Hands up, who likes me? Damn! Right, that's it. I'm going to kill myself. Then you'll be sorry.
No, we won't.
It was dynamite, and they were very exciting to have around, and they were also kind of a little bit bowled over by what we were doing as well, which was a delight for me because we were working in isolation. I had been going to Europe and America looking at stuff, but these guys reassured young talents in Australia that, in fact, what was going on in Melbourne at that time in the early 80s and late 70s, from the late 70s, was pretty damned exciting.
Like, I don't know if you know, but I'm in this amazing new wave band called The Room Clearers, right?
Wow! That freaked me out, Tim. That's really uncanny, because I know a guy in The Room Clearers.
Me too. Wow. But, like, obviously Bob Hawke has got no conceptualization of what it's like trying to manage a pre-Raphaelite, new wave, heavy metal, swing 50s experimental rock band, right?
I know.
Just goes to show how out of touch he is with ordinary people, right?
Excellent. Consensus equals nonsense.
In every other kind of version of history, apart from yours, it's actually the 25th anniversary. Because
they're wrong. They're lying. They're cheating.
Because they reckon it's 1987, and it was the time when you invited Peter Cook, in fact, to come and launch the official Melbourne Comedy Festival.
I would love to claim that I did that, but in fact, it was a guy called Greg Hocking who got Peter Cook to come.
Uh-huh. But you were working with Greg at that time.
Yeah. We had spent the preceding year making plans for this festival with the assistance of the government, and we wanted somebody big and special to come, and Greg was able to talk Peter Cook into coming, which was quite a terrifying experience. I went out to the airport with others to pick him up, and I turned into a gibbering wreck because I'm one of those people who thought Pete and Dud were probably, certainly Peter Cook was one of the greatest comics of all time. And I didn't know what to say to him. It was really embarrassing. I just dribbled.
And he was invited because everybody wanted to meet him and everyone was a fan. That was the main reason.
Absolutely. He was chosen. And that's the way it should be with a festival. It should be a celebration. And we were celebrating the fact that he was one of the giants of comedy for those of us of the generation that were around at that time. And the press conference to launch the Melbourne Comedy Festival was astonishing. It was the biggest. It was bigger than a prime ministerial press conference. There was Barry Humphries as Sir Les, who was the patron, who we talked into being the patron. And I had to write his patron's note at 3 a.m. with a pencil and a piece of paper sitting in my bed while he was calling from London, testing his jokes on me. It was hilarious. But they did it together. And Barry was Sir Les, and he had there was a wet slab of cement, a concept thought up by a guy called Shane Maloney who was involved. And Les flopped his donger out, which was huge, and made his mark in the wet cement in front of the largest assembled television, radio and print media I had ever seen in my life. And Peter Cook sat with this bemused look on his face. But it was a great beginning to an event which has obviously gone on for 26 years, not 25.
It was all set in basically two blocks in Brunswick Street and Smith Street. And you could do three venues in a night if you had a bicycle. and it was all people who, I guess we all felt there must be something in the future, but today a young comedian gets up on stage and his vision of it is of a Tonight Show or a Drive Time or a breakfast shift on FM radio. There's a purpose to their ambition now. But in those days, I think it really was people doing it for the fun, and I'm sure most people still do it largely for the fun, but there is some sense now that you've become a multi-millionaire if you're lucky.
Shane Maloney, who's now an author, but who was the general manager, says that those days were awful. In fact, he spent most of his time chasing shysters.
Well, that was the promoter's side of the business, and that's the side of the business which I knew about, and probably some of those shysters are still around. No, it was very difficult, and I was on the board of the Comedy Festival for the first decade or so, and I remember one board meeting which we had in a private room above a pub in Johnson Street. It was a big circular table, and there were, I think, 12 board members, and we walked into that room, and every setting around the table had a rubber knife, a plastic gun, and a hand grenade, and that was Shane just telling us that this is. But at the level of performers, particularly the early years, it was very collegiate. My strongest memory of that first comedy festival was the first week of the festival, only about 50 shows and not many venues, but the sense that the things that we'd been working for had found a proper place in the life of Melbourne was really palpable, and people were happy, they were embracing one another, and it was a really wonderful, wonderful sensation.
It wasn't funny. I had a terrible time. I don't think I had a laugh at all.
John Pinder not having the last laugh. And before him, Rog Quantock, the elder of the Comedy Festival, who was there when it all began and is still performing this year, not one but two shows, the history of the Melbourne Comedy Festival, a walking tour, and the Insane Asylum, You're Standing in It. Both come highly recommended. One of the performing waitresses back in the last laugh days was Susan Proven, who has held the position of Comedy Festival Director since 1994.
I started out as a waiter, as everybody does, and then my role there was night manager, which basically meant running the nights in terms of organising the wait staff.
Were you there the day that Roger Evans vacuumed someone's plate away when they didn't like the food?
I used to do that quite regularly. I was there the night that he took off someone's shirt, silk shirt, when one of the waiters had spilt red wine on it, and he took off this poor, dragged her out into the kitchen and took off her shirt and dunked it in a ice bucket of white wine with this woman, a look of horror on her face while he did this all the time, swearing that this would fix it.
Years on, things have changed a lot. What are the numbers like now? Because it started out small and yes, Now it's huge.
It is huge. I think there's something like 390 shows in the festival, and it's become a real thing, particularly I think amongst Australian comedians, where it's the place where you start developing a profile. I spend a lot of time actually trying to talk people out of doing it because, the financial risks are substantial.
So much so that Susan Proven suggests that young wannabe funny people should have a car they can sell to pay the bills. You're listening to the Artworks feature on ABC Radio National. I'm Suzanne Donisthorpe. One of those young people who has risked her car is Lauren Clark. She's been a writer, director and producer of several shows over a number of years. She's also a keen observer of the comedy scene, and in her recent article in Mianjin magazine, Lauren has a tilt at the festival, claiming that it's lost its way over the years and is now more about commerce than comedians. And she goes into bat for the hundreds of small acts that aren't allocated a high-profile venue, don't get media attention, and as a result, get very few bums on seats.
My real critique of the festival at the moment is that I think it needs to sort of reanalyse itself, it needs to open itself up and become a little more transparent so that the participants in the festival, but also the audiences, can see how decisions are made about the program. And I think people, audiences, it is so massive and it's so fun and everybody loves going to it. And having that huge festival guide with all of those entries in it, it is a bit bamboozling. And for participants, there's a different sort of story going on, which is that it is very hard to put a show on, as Susan said. And it's thought there are also, I think, a couple of procedural roadblocks to that along the way.
Well, just before we get to those procedural roadblocks, Susan, what do you say to Lauren's critique about the corporate side of things standing in the way of creative new developments?
I don't see how you can say that's happening when you just need to look at the program and go and see some shows. There's nothing to stop people doing the festival. Mm. And most of the young performers who are involved, because, we talk to them all and actually do have a lot of interaction with them, and I'm, you know, surprised to hear that, because a lot of the performers that, you know, every year we talk to performers, there are those who haven't had a great time and who've lost money. Sure, they're not going to be happy. There are also those who have had a great kind of creative development and professional development that wouldn't have probably been pushed along as fast as it was without the opportunities of the festival. And you can't kind of say, well, let's just stop everything and go backwards, make it smaller. I mean, I think one of the lucky things about being in Melbourne is that if you want to be in that kind of environment that hasn't grown so large and where it is perhaps not quite so competitive, is that we have the Melbourne Fringe at the other end of the year, which has quite a substantial comedy program now, which is fantastic. And a lot of comedians now will try out or work up their new shows in the Fringe, and that's a really good opportunity to sort of start building a profile. And often they'll do that and then bring that show into the comedy festival, you know, or not.
Because the problem with making jokes about George W. Bush is if you do, there might be an American in the room who would have every right to stand up and just go, hey, buddy, you know, your leader took your nation to war without public approval as well. And we'd have to go, yeah, all right, we're even. And if they're smart, they go, no, we're not. You voted for your guy.
Let's talk about the kind of process of how it works. If you're a new and budding comic talent, you need $500 to get into the program. What else does the $500 buy you? And is there people who get a special deal if they are within a comedy festival run venue system? I mean, they tend to have a better time, don't they?
What Not necessarily at all. And there's certainly no special deal. It's just we provide, one of the things that we do is provide venues, because there's not enough
But
venues.
Not to everybody.
Well, no, we can't.
Yeah.
There's not enough.
So some people will have the festival assisting them with their venue, and other people will have to find their own venue and find their own staff and all that stuff. And so therefore their financial risk is obviously bigger than the people
depends.
Who have
A lot of
the
people
festival
go,
supporting them.
You know, there are people going to the Arts Centre, there are people going to the Comedy Club, there are people going to, you know, Tuxedo Cat, which is a little venue run set up each year by an independent, and a lot of comedians prefer to go there. You know, they've either got, this is local comedians, because they've either got established relationships with those venues. It's really cheap to do that. It's much cheaper to do a show in like Softbelly, for example, than it is to do it in one of the venues that we provide, because our venues are, you know, they're expensive to build and we have to charge back.
Now, Lauren, you think that there's a kind of conflict of interest here in the way the festival manages and produces various acts,
I think,
don't you?
The festival plays three roles. They play the role of the decision maker in terms of who gets what venues, who gets what time slots. They also play
in some venues. In the venues that we
That's
run.
That's right, in
yes.
the venues that you run.
Which is exactly what happens in other big festivals.
Well, not always. And also the festival, so the festival has its own venues that it runs, and it selects certain acts to be in those venues. How that selection process works is something a lot of people I spoke to said they were in the dark about and found very confusing and opaque. Also, the festival produces some international acts as well. So that's another. Now I'm not saying that necessarily that there are all these special deals, to use your word, Suzanne, but I am saying we don't know. Nobody knows. It's really unclear. It's not stated anywhere.
Well, I'm stating it here. There's no special deals. Everyone pays the same.
No, I'm not suggesting there are special deals, but I'm suggesting that those three roles necessarily appear to the vast number of people who are doing shows to be in conflict. And actually, for audience members to not understand those distinctions, I think that's a really... that's a really important thing.
What's the criteria for getting one of those festival managed venues?
It varies from can you, like in the bigger, you know, the 400, 500 seats or the 1400 seats of the main room of the town hall, it's, you know, can you sell that many seats? We need to strike a balance filling those venues between making sure that we've got enough things in there that are actually going to sell a reasonable number of tickets and therefore generate the income that we need to pay for running the venue. And we also take the opportunity to put to give the small, because we've got a number of rooms like 30 seat, 40 seat, 50 seat venues, and that's a great opportunity to support really up and coming young Australian performers.
Now, Lauren, what do you think about that? I mean, there is a tension about how you sell a show. You've got big people like David O'Doherty, obviously they get more media, they get more of the audience attention. People have that kind of tendency to want to go and see shows that come from overseas because they've come especially for the festival where the local acts are here all the time. I mean, how does someone who isn't as well known compete with a big act like that?
Well, and I think they should compete,
in a fair way.
Well, I've never said, by the way, that the festival should be smaller and that we should go back to the old days. As for the international acts, I think yes, it's hard to compete, and it's especially hard to compete when the producer of the international act is also the festival, who also is in charge of who gets what venue in the town hall precinct and who gets what time slot.
Most of the overseas artists, they're not taking away venues from Australians, because most of the emerging young Australians, they don't need venues that are that big. So, you know, that kind of
They do take the attention, though. You've got to admit that. You can't possibly compete.
Of course they do, but so do the high-profile Australians.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so does Will Anderson and Josh Thomas, yep, and Judith Lucy and Denise Scott and Tom Gleeson and Sammy J and Randy. I mean, we are an international festival. That's what we do. We are proud of creating an environment where the best contemporary comedy from around the world is coming into Melbourne. But our audiences are not dumb. They will go and find good shows, and they do, and they have proved that, you know, again and again.
Lauren, in your article you say that the festival markets a kind of nostalgia for the early days. Is it nostalgic, or is it a kind of a mythological past that is haunting everybody and haunting proceedings? Is Rod Quantock's Rubber Chicken, you know, mocking everybody from the bus as they go past?
Those things were great, and they were so influential and created a...
an atmosphere.
Creative ferment and an atmosphere, but that was it was smaller then. Things grow, and you know, I do object a bit to the, you know, that used to be really cutting edge and rat baggy, and I think, well, if you look in the program, that is still there. It's just the program is a lot bigger now, and you need to go hunting for it.
Which I actually said in my essay, and I went to some length to say that, and I saw 54 comedy festival shows last year, so I have seen a lot of festival shows, and I know a lot of artists who are doing cutting-edge things. But I think that when the structure of the festival and the way the festival works is geared towards getting the right time slots and the right venues and trying to compete promotion-wise with bigger acts who are supported by the festival or who are in festival-supported venues, I think that makes it really hard for those acts to continue to really be as cutting edge as perhaps they are elsewhere. So I think that's a shame.
That's what happens in Edinburgh. It's what happens in Adelaide. It's the nature of the beast. It's always going to be like that. That's, you know, that's showbiz.
Celebrity comedy has taken over. People want to see the ones that are on television or on the radio. And they go into big venues that cost lots of money and charge big prices for tickets. And they suck it up. And it's very hard for new comics to get the air to breathe in the media. And the recommendation always is to go and see somebody you've never heard of and never seen before. If you can't find half a dozen shows that are exactly suited to your sense of humour, then you really don't have a sense of humour.
The elder statesman of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, Rod Quantock. And before him you heard Festival Director Susan Proven, Festival Founder John Pinder, and Writer and Director Lauren Clark, speaking to Suzanne Donisthorpe for this Artworks feature celebrating the Comedy Festival's 25th year. We must give the last laugh, though, to one of the overseas comedians who's performed at several festivals.
The only real reason I came, I don't want to see Uralu or Wurraluralu or any of your other garden fate exhibits. The only real reason I came here is to kill a wiggle.
Who else but Dylan Moran? And the laughs and pratfalls of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival continue for this year until the 24th of April. I'm Amanda Smith, and you're listening to ABC Radio National.